Ever wanted to try an Olympic and Paralympic sport? Try fencing. It's fast, safe, and easy to start. Find a beginner class near you at usafencing.org/try-fencing. That's usafencing.org/try-fencing.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to the Theorist Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and their compositions, hosted by music theorists. My name is Aaron DiZarilla, and I'm a graduate music theory student at Florida State University, and I'll be your host for today. The music that you were just listening to is an excerpt from the song titled Close to Something by the artist project titled The Housing Crisis, also known as the singer-songwriter Dylan O'Brien, who, alongside his music, is the featured guest for this episode. That leads me to welcome Dylan, the housing crisis himself, to the program. How are you?
Doing pretty good, Aaron. How about you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have you on. You know, it's kind of interesting that in terms of the lifespan of this show, I've probably had you on my calendar the longest because I talked to you quite a bit ago about actually being on this show, which of course you were receptive, but as we will get to very soon, there's a particular reason why the episode is being released when it is. So I'm happy to finally have you on. But for the audience, how about you go ahead and introduce yourself personally, professionally, academically, however you choose.
Yeah, sure. My name is Dylan O'Brien. I'm 23 years old. I make music. I produce music, write songs. I'm a live audio engineer for work. So a lot of that takes up my time and just out here just living life and breathing and creating music, listening to music.
Yeah, that's all good stuff, especially the breathing part. I think you should keep that up.
Yeah, I love that part.
Yes. So great. You're an audio, you said an audio engineer on a daily basis. What does that comprise of?
Yeah, so it can mean all sorts of things. I mean, technically, it's stuff that I do for fun and at work. But when I'm working, like for money and whatever, that is mostly live audio engineering work, which can either be like mixing bands at local venues in town here in Gainesville, or working for various like production companies. One in particular that I work for a lot, just like a dude who has a bunch of audio and lighting equipment and gets contracts by sometimes the city of Gainesville, sometimes private events, sometimes stuff in Jacksonville. And then we'll go and like build a PA for, you know, outdoor events as well as venues and stuff. And just run like the audio or lighting things throughout the day for events.
That's a lot. But I mean, you're incorporating a part of your creative skill. So, I mean, there's a creative element in audio mixing as well. Not to say that that's not creative, but
yeah,
your creative exploits, you're still using the same skills in the day-to-day work. So that's always the goal. Something funny about audio engineering, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I remember another person I've had on the podcast who did part-time, or just not part-time, but he did audio engineering work outside of his academic exploits, was Cameron Gwynn. And he did his first master's at Miami University. And he used to work for a club or some bar, and he would mix the audio. And he told me one of the most memorable nights that he ever had was a the owner of the bar came up to him at like 11:30 p.m. on a Sunday and said, "Cameron, we need to turn up the volume. We need to make sure these people can't hear their thoughts." So I'm not saying that that's what you're doing, but that just reminded me of that. So
Oh, I've had that note sometimes. One thing that I had to mix one time, it's crazy. It'll go from like one day I'm mixing like heavy metal, like doom, post-hardcore doom music, and then like the next day I'll be at like a private school, like elementary school, like mixing their musical or something, putting the mics on the little kids. It's like the whiplash is crazy.
I'm
But
sure. I'm
the
sure.
loudness, one thing I mixed was something that's pretty famous here in Gainesville called Fest, which is like an international hardcore and heavy like music, punk music festival here. And I mixed at a bigger venue here called the Woolly, like nine bands straight all day, all of them, each one louder and like bigger and louder th than crazier than the last one. And yeah, I think it's made me to the testament of your story there, I think in my experience that has made me appreciate the quiet a lot more and silence than before I started working and doing this.
I'm sure your ears get very tired at the end of the day with a lot of things. And so I do know about Fest because here's a little bit of background is that well, you didn't include this initially, but I guess I'll spill the beans. You also went to the University of Florida and you're
It's true.
based out of Gainesville for right now. We didn't really, I did my bachelor's at University of Florida as well. And we didn't really know each other necessarily. I would say light acquaintances. We had the music history sequence together. I remember talking to you the day that your project's first album came out, which we'll talk about that. But I remember when you were promoting that. I know you were in the composition studio there. I remember when I first found out about Fest, I thought, out of all places, Gainesville? Really?
I know, right?
It's a cool but odd thing or tradition in Gainesville. But
Yeah, for sure.
I suppose this leads me into the next question. As I said,
All right.
you were at University of Florida, and I know that you were there primarily for composition. You were in the composition studio. And so you have what many people, I guess it's just easy to classify as traditional institutional compositional training. You took composition lessons and so on. How has that influenced your thinking and writing? Obviously, it teaches you, or they help you mold how to write music literally, and you might get a trick here or there. But how has the institutional training helped mold your artistry?
I would say it just helps frame, it's helped frame how I just think about everything while I'm writing and while I'm composing in the first place. It's just like the frame of thinking. Like there are some concepts that I didn't even know to think of writing music like in these sort of terms or know what to listen for. Elements like even just basic stuff like the one professor of composition I worked with a lot and did private lessons for 2 semesters with was Dr. Scott Lee. One thing that he taught me for sure was like that I still apply now to pop music and whatnot is the idea of like background, middle ground, foreground, for example, of like what even just thinking about like these various parts in a song or in a piece, like sometimes you will subconsciously feel like I don't know why I don't like this. I like all the parts, they're cool or whatever, but it's something it's and sometimes that's just as simple as like, well, maybe you got two things that are trying to compete for the foreground at the same time, even though you like both of them. And things like that still affect me, and all of the different types of music that I was exposed to and had to listen to throughout the sequence of those classes and lessons have been really huge. It was very similar to it kind of paralleled my experience with my instrument when I was there initially, being voice. I did like two full semesters, I think, of voice lessons and whatnot, and being in the voice studio.
I didn't know that. What voice part were you?
Baritone.
Okay.
Which you would not expect from my speaking voice, but it goes down there, you know, whatever, when I'm singing. But I feel like that is all about having those lessons. I feel like is about notice having someone that's like really knows how to listen to another person's voice, like point out these unconscious habits and behaviors that you have that you don't even realize you're doing, and like can say every time that you're doing it, like, here, let's this, well, you're doing that with your voice, you know, like relax, whatever it is. And I would say the same thing, like just over time, would happen with my composition private lessons, where if there was ever moments of frustration directed internally, it would be like the kind that help you grow from the respect of like Dr. Lee always sort of pointing out the thing, my tendencies and bad habits that are like hard to break, and like having someone that can dial in on just those aspects of it and work those out was very useful.
I never had private composition lessons. Of course, getting a bachelor's in music theory, you don't do such things, but I took comp skills, and I had comp skills with Dr. Lee, took arranging and also electroacoustic music. Great guy, great professor, yeah. Dr. Lee. Yeah. I really like him. Saw him recently. He did a master class at Florida State.
Nice.
So that was fun to see him again. So here's a question. You were in the academic circle, part of the institution, and we're going to talk about the institution and such later in the last part of this podcast, but I'm always interested in the topic of labels, because on a fundamental level, they may not necessarily matter, but I like to discuss this to see how people perceive themselves or the world. And so the label of commercial music, in some ways, that label exists just out of convenience, because it's easy to separate something that is being performed at composition festivals with sheet music on a stage with a more traditional style ensemble, maybe with an auxiliary instrument or something like that, versus something that is put on Spotify. And I guess this is, I'm not going to preview it too much, but I'm going to have a guest on in a little bit, in a couple weeks from, or actually the next week from the recording of this episode, that has traditional like piano, violin, and all that actually recorded on tracks and all that. And it's composed like it's a classical piece, but it's also on Spotify. So is that commercial music? Is it not commercial music? Fundamentally, isn't everything commercial music? Because you want to make money off of it, unless if you're making it just for the point of it. And then at that point, the distinction loses its difference. So it gets kind of messy. To a point, the label of commercial music is just out of convenience. But it can also have some loaded connotations as to separate it from, oh, well, it's just for money. Whereas this is art music. Well, isn't all music art? You know, so then sometimes it becomes a value judgment. And I know as part of the composition studio, taking composition classes, I'm sure these are the sorts of things you've also thought of. You've had hands in both pots of a kind. So can you just talk, not necessarily the industry and the institution, but the concept of those different labels? How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Oh, man. This is such an excellent topic. There's so many thoughts about this.
Go for it.
I feel like commercial music, that is such an interesting term. And I think that to me, when I think of commercial music, well, I think in a greater scheme of things, probably the word that I just use for most of that is just, well, okay, there's popular music, right? That's just like music of a popular tradition that's, you know, that people might listen to on the radio, or things that sound like what you might hear on a radio and might make money from that way, versus, you know, art music that's more sometimes academic in nature, or the person that makes it might identify themselves as like a composer. I think that commercial music for me, if I were to define it, or how I think about that in my head, it probably has a more narrow meaning, more specific meaning, in that it probably, like, I think of it as almost the type of music that you could think of as like decoration, like music that you might actually, that's probably like that's paid for to maybe be in the background somewhere, and the composer designs it with that in mind. Or like music that is made for literally like commercials or things of that nature. Or, you know, there's entire, like, for example, sync libraries now where it'll just be like, relatively easy to make sort of lo-fi music, like chill sort of lo-fi hip hop music, for example, or other genres that it's almost like ambient music, but it's design. It's not like Brian Eno meticulously creating like an ambient piece. It's like made maybe more quickly to be like uploaded to a sync library where a chain of like 50 Starbucks or whatever can, the corporation will like pay to have all of them able to like stream and sync like libraries of music. That's kind of like one example.
That's, I think, interesting. So to break you off right there, I mean, if we're not being picky, I don't think you would argue against the label of commercial music for your own if we're not being picky, but we're being picky. Would you consider your music commercial music?
No, and here's my kind of half funny, half serious answer for that is that I feel like a lot of music is probably not commercial music because commercial music implies that there's actually some commerce taking place where you're actually making money from it. So it's like most of us are not making any money from it.
Let's get into, I love these sort of things. This is why I'm a music theorist. I'm not asking you to divulge, but I'm assuming you've made some money off of your Spotify.
Yes.
Are you there for commercial?
No.
Let's do another is, if, and this is all in good taste, I'm not challenging.
Oh yeah,
you.
No, I'm having so much fun. This is great.
So another one is, Dylan, it's the hope. I hear the housing crisis on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Are you now pop music?
Yes. Here's the thing. I fully embrace pop music, and I have a lot of strong opinions about the perception of pop music being like within academia being a little outdated and a little close-minded sometimes.
Very. I'll back you up on that. I don't know if you've heard some of the other things I've said on this show, but just to give you a lay of where I come from, I would classify myself as someone who, if I specialize in anything, it's pop music.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally get that. I did a presentation on Pitbull. I mean,
nice.
Continue.
Pitbull,
yeah, yeah.
I would say, is commercial, and he's pop music and it's commercial. You know, because pop I think of as the you know, an indicator of style or an indicator of what tools or ways of thinking you're using when you're creating the music from the start, and it being maybe influenced by the things that you've listened to, like that have also been in the more, you know, folk common people music traditions if it were hundreds of years ago, whatever. But I think of commercial artists, I think of them as the people that can maybe actually sell tours and things, you know, that can actually make like money going on tours. And I've gotten to know some of those bands now from work and from also just the music. And it's the next, you know, it's a next level. I feel like it's probably more fair to say commercial music once there's like, once you have more fans and once your music is at like a higher level. Like one group of people I've gotten to know a bit from playing two shows with them, and also like that I know from playing with them on the housing crisis, like music side of things, but also I got to work with them in April for a music festival as like the audio engineer side of things, is the band Flip Turn. They're like my perfect example of when you have like more fans, when you have more people just listening to your music across the country or the world, then other types of like music business people and whatnot start to like have an interest in helping you or the band like make a tour happen or make all these things happen at higher levels, because there's now a lot of money involved. You know, like when people pay $50 on the low end for a ticket, and then there's like, you know, 1,000 people there, you know, you have, that's a lot of money, you know, at the start. And I think that inherently just in pop music has such a different multitude of like complexities, different things attached to it, than just bedroom producers, people that are just in band, like local bands that are making music that want to break into having more fans and whatnot.
Yeah. Oh, we could go on for days and hours about these sort of labels, which
Yeah.
I love. But to surmise, essentially, this is interesting. It's not a description that I've heard. I don't think I've heard before, at least not very often, that the specific label of commercial music to yourself is like a threshold that is reached at some point.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. I don't think I disagree. I'm not sure if I fully agree, but thank you for that. I think
Yeah.
that's a very interesting way to look at it. You're also in that area, and I would say, because you're signed to a record label, not, hope, I hope for your good wishes that you blow the hell up
Right.
with your charts and stuff, but I would say you're, in my personal definition, you're coming close to the lexicon of that, which,
Okay.
yeah, I mean,
Well,
I
that's cool.
just,
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, here's like how I would also sum it up differently or and shorter as well, that I didn't maybe touch on is like, and this is also sometimes not fair to try to label other people because you don't know like their intentions or where they're coming from.
Of
But
course.
sometimes you can tell like with certain artists, like I don't want to hate on any popular artist too much, but like there's some where you can tell like this just feels more manufactured or something or less authentic. I also sometimes think of that as commercial from like what is your drive in creating the music?
So you're telling me that JoJo Siwa is not an art music
Well,
producer?
that's again also
I get, I'm being facetious. I get what you're
yes,
saying. I
exactly.
get, yeah.
And for me, it's like for me, it's my pop music for sure. This is probably pretty obvious to say, but I feel like it's art because that's what drives me. I feel like my label is I think of myself just as an artist. That's like kind of the only word I really use because it's like I don't know, it's like whatever tickles my fancy, you know? It's like learning to produce was really fun. It's also like making music's really fun. It's yeah, it's just art, you know?
Yeah, and
That's yeah.
that jumps forward a little bit too. Thank you for moving along the
Yeah,
conversation with
you're
that.
welcome.
Sorry for that, a bit of a detour, but I
No,
love
I
those
like
sort of
it.
conversations because, again, like I said, I don't think at the end of the day the labels will matter too much, but it's a way to explore perceptions of life,
Yes,
so
yes.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But so you label yourself an artist primarily. Which is a question I was going to ask later. And I find it interesting. So if we're going to go between, let's be really basic here and not granular. There's two different kinds of music essentially that I have on this podcast. There's classical and then commercial, which we've already talked about how that is problematic or at least not very descriptive. But
Yeah.
let's just stick with that for right now.
Sure.
You are one of three people right now that I have had on the podcast that are in commercial. And the first one, Lucy from the group Violencia, describes themselves as an artist. They chose that label. And Ben Williams chose producer. And both of it was because of the space and the field that they're occupying. And I'm assuming that is similar to yourself.
Yes. And I would also, I mean, I would say I'm a producer for sure, but I don't think of it maybe as much in those terms. I feel like the end, like engineering the music, falls under my artistic process for me. Like the housing crisis, at least, is like, I don't think it would be the housing crisis thus far. Maybe one day if I can get like a producer that I like idolize or something to produce an album, a housing crisis album or something. But like right now, like me be having control over engineering and producing the music itself is something that like falls under the artistry of it for me, you know? But
That
that's
makes
different for everyone.
yeah, that makes sense. And also, you clearly have a lot of knowledge and flexibility in the world of producing because you do that in other ventures, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
So, speaking of the housing crisis, who you are other than Dylan,
Yeah.
so let's talk about the housing crisis. One, can you talk about that name? I find it very intriguing. Does it have
Yeah.
to do with the housing crisis of the late mid and late 2000s? And just the history of it was a group at one point, I remember, and now it's a solo project. Just can you talk about it?
Sure. Yeah. So, the housing crisis. Basically, I'm like a year graduated from undergrad by now, and my very first year of college, I was an engineering major, just like not audio engineering, just like straight up like STEM. What
God
is that?
bless you. God bless.
Yeah.
I
Thank
don't
you.
know.
Yeah. The poor young Dylan. I thought that that's what I wanted. I like math and science stuff. I was doing that. But really, that year was the first time in my life that I started to write songs. And me and my old best friend from middle and high school, who like went to school across the country, as I was starting to write songs, we'd always like been really creative musically together and did different things. Like we'd cover Beatles songs and did musical theater and stuff when we were younger. But at this point, I was finally starting to like super scared and write my own songs and stuff. And we would collaborate and stuff like long distance, and it was really towards the end of that first year where COVID began. It was like March of 2020, and we were no longer going to really be collaborating anymore. I still love him to death. He's still like one of my old fa like best friends for life, but we both kind of wanted to like direct the music and stuff. We were clashing a little bit creatively, and so the kind of backlash against that was like, now I'm a little more confident at writing songs. We had written a few songs together and performed them once or twice and like recorded them in a studio. But now it's like the backlash was wanting to just have full control over everything, partly because I wanted to, but then also because going to a studio was about to not be feasible anymore because it was March 2020. So I was like, well, now's the time to just like learn how to do all of this in my bedroom, watch a lot of YouTube videos on like recording things and whatnot. And yeah, I really like I just in March 2020, I think I was like just keeping like a running list of project names, artist names, band names in my notes app, just like as I thought of them. I still do that with like song and title names these days, but that was like the start of it. And on one level, I think I probably thought of the housing. I actually really don't remember exactly where it came from, but I know I probably thought that it was similar to the band name The Postal Service, who I really liked. And so I probably thought that was cool. And on another level, I feel like it must like it, and it does have something to do with the like 2008, 2009 like financial crisis and whatnot, because that was like kind of an event in me and my parents' life that just kind of like created a sort of that just like fully altered the path that we were on, because we're living in upstate New York from when I was born until like 2009, and
What part of upstate New York?
just outside of Syracuse, a little
Oh,
place
okay.
called Camillus. Yeah.
I've been plenty to Rochester and
Okay.
Holly, New York.
Right
So
on.
I
Yeah,
ask.
one of my half brothers and his family lives in Rochester. The place is
Okay.
awesome.
Anyways, continue, continue.
So I think my parents could like n not afford their house anymore or something, like a lot of people. And so we decided to have like just sort of a fresh start and just move to Florida, where it's sunny and warm and not like cold and miserable anymore, and like be by the beach. And just like they kind of I felt like had a change of character from it, and we're like a lot happier from it. But it for sure just like altered the sort of course trajectory of your life, you know. So that's I don't know, that's kind of where the name comes from. I think the only other thing that I didn't answer was kind of I'll say this part's kind of quickly, like the evolution of the project. It's basically always creatively, for the most part, and I'll explain the exception. Like it's been like a solo creative project. In that part of why I chose a name like that, well, is for one, my name is Dylan O'Brien, which is spelled differently, but is phonetically the same sounding as a famous actor, Dylan O'Brien. So that's
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think
like
about
Maze
that.
Runner and stuff. Yeah, shout out to that guy. So I was like, okay, this is gonna be annoying if I just go by my name. And so that was one level, but I also was like inspired a lot by artists that have those sort of like where it could be a band, but you can't tell, like the microphones. Was inspiring me, and that's just one person. Car seat headrest initially was one person. Tame Impala, you know, those sort of things. But yeah, we've played live like a band before, just from having like music friends that really believed in like the stuff that I was making, and just would find it fun to play like it out as a band. But then for our first album, that for sure was a lot more collaborative, because in order to, that was the first thing where we really had like live drum kit on everything. And so now my current super best friend and collaborator, Trevor Griffin, he at the time was the drummer for the band. And there was definitely a lot of like interplay with, I would have these songs, but then we'd be in the studio and I would sort of explain my idea for drums and like my vague language and whatnot. And he would make them real and added a lot of his own style to it. So for sure, a lot of that credit rhythmically on that album is him, but yeah, there's my rambling about it. There you go.
Oh, not rambling at all. Thank you okay, for that. Good. And yeah, you know, I asked specifically about, you know, part of it's a joking, but part of it's not, about the relation to the real life housing crisis. And there is ongoing housing crises all across the country in different locations, primarily urban cities and affordable living. So on, that's a very complex issue. But the name paired with the aesthetics of your music feels nostalgic. And that's a very hard thing to quantify. That's not to say it has old sound, because mm-hmm. that's different. Having an old sound and being nostalgic are very different. You know, it's the difference between watching Back to the Future and Stranger Things. You know, it's not that strong of a nostalgia, because I don't think you're trying to evoke an exact time. Your music isn't melancholy, but there's like an underlying comfort to it that comes with nostalgia. I don't know if that's just my own perception. That's a very hard thing to quantify, and we're gonna get to that a little bit more when we talk about the specifics of Closer to Something, but that's why I bring that up.
Yeah.
So about your music, about the housing crisis and the sound, in the publicly available descriptions of the housing crisis, you describe the music as, or the project as, a Baroque pop electronic project. So I get electronic, and from the music in this episode, and I encourage you all obviously to go check out the housing crisis on the available streaming platforms in the description of this episode. Electronic is not hard to find in the sound, but Baroque pop. Now, as someone who not too long ago just said that he is fascinated by labels and thinks about them often, I've never heard of that one. So yeah. Can you describe what Baroque pop is?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, I've been waiting for someone to ask me this question for the world to hear. This is wonderful. It's a label I found a few years ago as I was finding the music that would ultimately super inspire the housing crisis and stuff in the early years of it, that originated in the mid to late 1960s with some of those like mid to late era Beatles albums, as well as Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, which is like a seminal, like incredibly important work for me and for what I'm doing, is Pet Sounds. And I grew up listening to the Beatles. Like, I would exclusively listen to the Beatles, but also obsessively every day, like from like third through sixth grade.
What's your favorite album?
I can't choose one. That's like my immediate answer for that. Okay. I've been listening to Abbey Road a lot the last couple of days, but it's always different. Always.
Okay. Fair enough.
So Baroque pop is a label where it's like pop music, and also very often, because of the era that it originated, it also kind of implies rock as well. But where the Baroque kind of comes into that label is it's like pop music that's marked by having a sort of harmonic structure of the songs that makes you think of Bach and some of these, like, and like counterpoint and some of these chord progressions or harmonic things that were happening, like, yeah, from Bach and in that era. Like, it reminds me a lot. It's like strange overlap of one of the skills that I was not expecting actually to kind of be helpful in one way from like my early music theory classes, like one and two, theory one and two and stuff, is like the Roman numeral analysis, where it's like, now actually writing it all out I don't do that now, but like the idea of those parts and some of the counterpoint stuff I learned like from Dr. Lee, it's basically just a type of pop music that uses like those types of harmonies, either in just whatever the all the instruments are, but sometimes also specifically in the vocal harmonies and stuff. I find that super present on Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, what Brian Wilson was doing and what the Beatles were doing. But also a lot of the music that I'm super inspired by is Baroque pop that's like maybe labeled as that because it's artists that are like older adults by now, but were, you know, making things in like the 90s and 2000s and whatnot, and maybe 2010s, that was also that they were inspired by Brian Wilson and by the Beatles and whatnot, like in their stuff they were doing then. So there's some artists that one of the artists that's like super inspirational to me that I look up to a lot, that's just like one of the few that's on the plane for me of like Pet Sounds as an album, is an artist that goes by the name Panda Bear, who's a member of Animal Collective, that band. But his, and I love Animal Collective, but like Panda Bear's like solo albums and whatnot, like the harmonies that he'll sing just sound so like perfect and beautiful. But it'll, when you're actually thinking about like what the notes are and stuff, and using like, I think of stuff in like Roman numerals, you know, it'll just be like technically these parts will just be like 1, 5, or like the chords of the song will just be combos of like 1 and 4 and 5. And I love when you can actually pull that off in a way that feels like new or different. Yeah, I don't know. It's something about that.
Understandably. Yeah,
Yeah.
I was very fascinated by the label of Baroque pop because, you know, the word Baroque is evoking, as you said, an older period of music, classical music. And one example of the Beatles I can think that is exactly that is Blackbird, which uses an excerpt from a Bach piece at the beginning with the guitars.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
It is very apparently. John and Paul were sitting playing exercises, and they just really liked how that sounded on the guitar. So
Wow.
th there's an exact copy of that. But interesting, interesting.
Course, George Martin, their producer, had like a super classical background.
I
You
didn't
know,
know
they'll
that.
write a song and then, yeah, like they would write a song and bring it to him, and then he would be the one that would kind of help them imagine and then like create like orchestral parts and stuff, like Eleanor Rigby, whatever, you know.
And also on the topic of the simplicity of the quote, also I want to say about your comments about the helpfulness of early theory classes. I rag on the music theory establishment very often, but that sort of stuff is very important
Yeah, like
as
actually,
fundamental stuff.
it
You
is. I hate to say it.
no, I you know what? I love to say it. It
I know
is.
you would. That makes sense.
I would.
Yeah.
It is incredibly important. You can go off in your life and do what you want with it, but it's very important. But
That I agree
no,
with.
my favorite song and piece of music, not just song, but piece of music of all time is Stand By Me by Ben E. King, which
Oh, wow.
has a chord progression of 1, 6, 4, 5 over and over with the same ostinato, bass line, and percussion licks. Over and
Oh, yeah.
over, but if you look at the notated melody, the counter melody in the bridge, and the duet with the violins, and so on, there is so much that you can expand and do past simple chords, as you were saying, you know, 1, 4, 5. There's a million and one different things you can do, of course. And so let's get into the element of today's episode. Of course, you are the primary element, the housing crisis, but the single Close to Something, which this is what I alluded to at the very beginning of the episode, is it is released right now. Now,
Yes.
not right now as of the time of this recording, but the time that anyone is hearing this, it was released midnight. So
Yes.
go and check it out. All the links will be in the description of the episode. You're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Is there another? I don't remember.
Yeah, you know, yeah, Apple Music,
Or
I
not.
pretty much ever. Yeah, well, this might be on Apple Podcasts,
This will be
what
on
we're doing
Apple
right now,
Podcasts, but
which will have a little bit of Close to Something in it, you know.
yes, it will. It
But
will.
it will, yeah, it'll be out everywhere. Yeah, any streaming service for sure.
Yeah,
Anywhere. And
so.
eventually on physical CD and cassette tape one day.
Yes. So we
Yes.
timed the recording, even though I asked Dylan quite a while ago to be on the show. We timed this with the release of the single, which I'm happy to be part of the promotion for. But before we get into Close to Something in depth, it's also part of a larger release schedule. This coming Friday, we have something very special for the housing crisis, a big time in your career, and I'll let you share that.
Yeah, this is coming this Friday is the release of my second sort of studio album called Trivial in the Greater Picture. And Close to Something is a pretty special track because it is the opening track of the album. So I waited until just we're kind of doing a more surprise release with this single that came out today. Whereas with the other three that have come out previously, those were more scheduled and announced to everyone ahead of time. And, you know, like, oh, in 1 week, listen to this or that. But this one, we're kind of like, surprise, here you go. And
I didn't know that. Oh, that's cool.
Well, I'm kind of like deciding it like as we're talking right now, a little under a week before. But I'm like, I think that's what I want to do with it. But we're talking like it's Monday right now. So that's what I've done. Past tense.
Past tense, of course. Yeah. Yes. All planned out.
Right.
But yeah, that was going to be my next question of you're part of a record label and a professional producing, dare I say, commercial artist.
Yeah, dare is the right word.
Dare is the right word. But so, yeah, that was going to be my next question of why Close to Something being the final promotional push for the album. And can you say the album name again?
Yes, Trivial in the Greater Picture. Yeah, and Close to Something. Yeah, you know, I chose it as the opener to sort of tease that. One thing that I did unintentionally, which I noticed, is now that all four singles are out, they come out in different orders and whatnot, but it's like the first two and the last two songs of the album. So kind of, you know, the way that you release singles now, it's kind of like a little EP of four songs. Not actually. But like a single, I guess, with four songs with those on it in a different order and stuff. And so part of it was just having this final single with all of them on there have like a nice flow to it with the sort of waterfall way of doing it where you have like one single. The first one comes out. And then when the second one comes out, the second single, the newest one, is the first song on the single. And the one from like a few weeks before or whatever is the second one beneath it. And then you keep like the third one would be that order, but the third one is first or whatever. And the fourth. Yeah. So this is like opening up the little four song single being the first one. It's also the first song on the album. And I think it's just to get people excited for the album. It's definitely a really special song compared to pretty much, it's pretty unique in a few ways compared to all of the other songs on the album, actually, which is also why, like, part of why it would be exciting for us to talk about it a bit. From the respect that, for one, the collaborator who I mentioned, who was our drummer for the longest time before we do electronic drums now, Trevor Griffin, he, this album is also kind of the first that's like almost entirely solo, where I've performed everything except this song. The electric guitar that happens kind of throughout is all Trevor Griffin playing that, and just his classic semi-hollow body tone that he's just so good on. And so I needed it somewhere. And he wrote like this part for it actually a while ago, a little over a year ago, maybe 14, 15 months ago, in like March and April of 2023. It was a couple months after my first album had come out. And that was when I was really beginning to put all of my eggs in the I'm going to start working on the next album. And let's also, I want to make it like electronic basket. And back then, he helped me play a few shows with guitar and he wrote that part for it. And so when it came to like many, many, many months later, time to actually record the final song, he just had such a cool version of it. And this song also is for sure the most unique. And maybe I can like send these to you so you can hear what I'm talking about. I might also try to like make a little Bandcamp, like probably for free or for a couple bucks release, just for people that really care. Probably most people won't. Or even I might just throw them on SoundCloud. But like this song has the most like versions of it that are almost like fully recorded versions that each is like different, that I just kept not being happy with, because I always knew, I think, that this was going to be the opener. And so there's like, you know, some pressure for it to be cool and or perfect, I guess. I'm more just like perfectionist. But there's probably like four or five, including the one that came out today, like fully different versions of this song. And so that's pretty unique too, which is almost like became ironic, or it felt like a cosmic joke at some point, because the song is called Close to Something. And I kept like, it's, I kept telling my roommates who are always hearing me work on the songs and stuff, like, it's all, it's so almost done, really, this time it's gonna be it. And I'm, there's still three more versions to record.
So here's a really easy question then. What, I say that ironically, what about this version made you say, okay, this is good, that this is what I'm going to go with?
I think that the answer is that throughout recording probably the first three or four versions, it was actually a great process that like I learned from as an experiment that will probably come into play in the future. Actually, like, on smaller levels affected the other songs too on the album that I was still working on at the time. But like the idea that each time that I would try like to fully make a new version of the song, I would learn things from it and would take small elements of the things that I tried that I liked and would keep those the same in the next version and whatnot. For example, like there were a lot of versions where I was trying to figure out the background harmonies and get those right. And I was liking it, but I just felt like something was missing. At some point on my gear journey, I somehow, I don't even know how I thought of this, but I sort of impulsively bought for like maybe like 80 or 90 bucks on eBay this rack unit effects box that's from the 90s, and it's called Digitech Vocalist VR. And it's a harmonizer unit. So different from a vocoder. It's like that sort of like processed vocal sound thing where it like it takes your one. It really just takes like the information that you're singing like and disregards like the notes that you're actually singing. And just on one, at least, will just like tune it to whatever one note you're sending it. But then also like three or four parts of harmony, it will also do. And you can either tell it what notes of the harmony to be exactly, or you can let it do its own like algorithmic 90s algorithm thing of like letting it spell it all out in some specific chord inversion or whatever itself. And so there's times where I was like, I had like a MIDI keyboard connected to it. And I'd be playing along and I accidentally played a few chords at different points that, or I like hit notes and it thought I was doing some like really complicated like chord that I wasn't. But then it sounded really cool. And I was like, whoa, wait, that's cool. And so I still don't really know what those chords are called or whatever, but there's a few of those, like when I sing the words like long, 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 love, love, love. There's like a few notes there, chords that were unintentional at first, but once I discovered that, I was like, okay, well, I got to redo it and make those like the actual chords in the song and make the other parts, like bake that chord in the other parts as well. So yeah, some of that stuff was happening.
Cool, cool. It's great to hear about the process, because not that classical writing styles are similar. There's 100 different ways to approach writing a notated piece, but I don't know, maybe it's my own personal lack of experience or knowledge in the space. It's always interesting hearing how an artist in your space approaches songwriting. Songwriting's a little bit different than piece writing.
It's true. But yeah, it's just that this one was super iterative. There was versions where like some of the early ones were like all these things I hadn't even really thought of, but are like, but now are super important. Like literally just the dynamics of how it all feels. Like the early versions were a lot like louder. And then I made a version like the third one or something around there where I like removed so much and made it just like the absolute bare bones of little things and just made it more sparse and literally the dynamics also quieter and whatnot. And learned from that where it's like, okay, I went too far in that direction with that one. Like this is still not I'm still going to do every single thing again and kind of go crazy for longer, but it's going to inform it. And so, yeah.
So about Close to Something in particular. So I made a list of observations, you know, the more analytical portion here. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go step by step with them. I just want to see or hear your reaction to them. So one of them, and I think this is even more particularly powerful knowing that this is the opener to the forthcoming album, that you start off with these powerful synths. And when I say powerful, I don't mean in like the like journey separate ways synths or something like that, but it's as we talked about earlier, it's in the foreground, it's bright, it's attention grabbing. And I described it in my notes to you as post-80s synths. And critiquing that little comment I made, I'm not even 100% sure what that means, because post-80s synths literally just means a synthesizer that is after the 1980s, which can mean a million different things. But it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the overall aesthetic of your music, is that it feels nostalgic and comforting, but it doesn't feel old. And the synthesizers at the beginning, just they feel like a recent flashback, not a very long flashback, but a recent flashback. I can't really describe much further than that. This is getting into like some really philosophical abstract music theory. So that's just the way that I perceived the synth. And you talk about your electronic influence, and that's an even more beautiful way to open up the entire album. So, and you talked about the difficulty of managing foreground, middle ground, background, layering, and also the concept of Baroque pop. I think that's especially accented, and again, even more so that this is the way that you're introducing your larger work on Close to Something. The intro is accumulative. It builds layers. The first is the synth, and then I believe next is the bass, and then that leads into the drums and guitar coming in together. So it's also an accumulative introduction, something similar to maybe in the classical Baroque time period of a gradual introduction of instrumental layers. You're doing that here too. Not the most uncommon in some popular music forms, but that just reinforces some of the elements that you're going for. So I got some of the post-80s synth, which again, that kind of is a meaningless label, but that's what I'm going with. Another evocation that I got with the drums specifically. I used the example in my notes to you of the Verve and Bittersweet Symphony with the way that the drums come in. It's not, I'm not saying the literal rhythm, it's just the feeling, the style. It's light punk, like really light punk. Like it's kind of a like early Green Day, maybe some Oasis if you want to throw that in there. And I think it's interesting you brought up the 90s vocoder, because I kind of get like alternate the beginnings of the quote unquote alternative scene, when it was becoming more popular in the 90s. So I got that feeling from the drums. And then probably the weirdest observation I made, and you can make fun of me for this, I just liked it, was the guitar. I compared it to a timbre of the Kenny Chesney song When the Sun Goes Down, which I put that in there because I think it's funny, but I also did just the timbre of the guitar is not authoritative. It's laid back, it's groovy. I got a real sense of a early 2000s country laid back vibe.
Oh, yes,
It's
with the guitar,
yeah,
yes.
with the guitar. So it's less about it being country-like. It's more the comforting laid-back feeling. And so it's this combination of things that makes me feel nostalgic, not to a specific time. I guess late 90s, early 2000s, if you want to put it at a time. That's also what makes me think of the housing crisis. You know, when we were young, you know, we're about the same age roughly. So it makes me think of a time that was when we were really young, and but it's not old sounding either. And so, okay, so I ask you this question. Post-80s synth, a meaningless term, early alternative pop rock, and Kenny Chesney. So do with that what you will.
This is I like oh my gosh. And I'm not saying this just to be flattering to you, but you have nailed so many, you got so much of that correct that
Really?
it's crazy actually. Like a good amount of it. Like
Awesome.
to be honest, 'cause I don't know exactly the song you're talking about, or it might be that sort of thing where if I heard it, I would like, oh, that Kenny Chesney. But that's the only part that I don't really know about or
If
can't
you
speak
went
to.
to a pool party between the years of 2005 and 2015, you probably heard
Okay, great.
it, but
So, yes, good. But yeah, wow. Okay, where to begin? Basically, post-80s synth is like also so, I'll start there. I think that's pretty on the money because, well, the easiest first thing to say about all this is that when I'm listening to pop music for pleasure these days, and honestly, for a number of years now since the housing crisis was forming, the band, the music, I definitely lean way, way more towards listening and having like musical discoveries within myself and whatnot from like 90s and 2000s, early and late 2000s, like indie music in general, or songwriters from those areas. And yeah, just all of that. That's still what I listen to the most. I make like monthly Spotify playlists for actually like 9 years straight of every month, like what I'm listening to that month. And if you were to go through all of them, there's definitely like, I definitely listen to modern things. For sure, a lot of stuff from the 2010s and the stuff that's coming out now, but it's like all of my favorite stuff is from the 90s, 2000s. So that just like can't help but like appear in the music that I'm making. And it's almost like skipping us like a certain gap of years where music, I don't know. I feel like in general, pop music tends to build off of all eras of pop music, but like with more of an emphasis on the things that just have been happening and like expanding those in like way more recent years. But for me, I feel like a lot of comments that I get of people hearing my music describing it in similar ways, but less like precisely. Like you did a great job.
Thank you. I got some music theory points.
Yes, for sure. You get a gold star for that for sure.
Yes.
But yeah, I get those comments, and I think that's because of what I listened to from those eras. Oh man, you had said so many things in that I want to address, but I'm like blanking on some of them now.
So there was post-80s synth where it's we said that. Another is early popular alternative music, which
Yes.
so, yeah, there's that one.
From those eras, yeah, I think that there's also like a certain interplay in this song between like this tension of, well, one word that you used, I think, in your notes was like a sense of anxiety. But
Yes.
contrasted, part of what's nice about it, I think, now that I'm able to like look back at the song with a little bit of separation and be able to like, because it's honestly a blur when you're actually making it. Like, I won't be able to say these things while like I'm blinded by the process of making it. But now with a little bit of time, I feel like what I like about it is, well, the song just in general is kind of it's not a coincidence that it's like called Close to Something and that some of the lyrics are like, get ready to start revealing. And having those feelings within me, like around writing it around the time that I'm graduating college, or like finishing my fourth year. So there's those senses in it that of like that excitement, but like, you know, anxiety can sometimes be excitement, but like you can be scared a little bit, it could be positive or negative, you know, there's that, but it's also contrasted by Trevor's electric guitar part having like an easygoing like nature to it. Where it's like those moments where you're building up to something, and then when it happens, you're like, oh, why did I need to like, I was so worried about it, but this is just like fun. I'm just having a good time. Like that happens a lot performing, where I'm like the day of a performance, the whole day I'm like anxious leading up to it and you know, have that anxious energy, and then it's just fun. Because I feel like, and it kind of encapsulates that this period of my life in the sense that you graduate and it's this big thing, but then you're just, and for me, not like for me, knowing pretty early on in college that I didn't want to keep doing academia or stay in music in that sense, but I really connected with the other elements of it, or like what I'm doing now, like at least knowing that, you know, that to say, I'm not planning on the next thing being like graduate school or something. It's like all this build up to graduating in this next phase of your life, but then, and then it's like all these exciting things like end up happening, but it's slow, or it's like, you know, that period after you graduate and you're like, oh, this is now just the rest of my life. Now I just work and make art. It's not like the next, you know, that's what like the verses kind of in the song are kind of conjuring, is the first, it kind of jumps around in time. Like the first set of lyrics, well, I'm going to give things away I don't normally do, just for the people. If you've made it this far, this is your reward, as I give a little bit away, which is like, well, first of all, the first lyric is kind of borrowed like from somewhat closely from one lyric in You Never Give Me Your Money by the Beatles on the album Abbey Road, because that song, like, that's just one of my favorite songs ever. And that song kind of reminds me of, it has a nostalgic feeling to it too. And it sings back to like a fictional previous time in like their lives. That's not real, but like, yeah, the first lyrics here is when I'm out of college and my money's spent, when I need a friend and I need a way to make rent. That's me just, you know, like that, you're close to something, but then it's that period. But then like at the second verse, I jump to like that different feeling, which is like at the end of May, at the end of sixth grade, in the middle of preparing for middle school is standing in my way. That's kind of my way of kind of referencing like all of these points in your life where earlier on you know that like you know what the next thing is going to be like pretty concretely. Yeah, just there being these different points where I, you know, you feel like you're close to something new or to, and you know, new chapters and whatnot. So that's an element of it. I will also say, it's very much inspired by that Beatles song, like I mentioned, but also in 2022, there was an album that I listened to so much that came out then that was a collaborative album between Panda Bear, who I mentioned is someone I really look up to, and also this artist named Sonic Boom, who does a lot of crazy electronic stuff, and came from that world from a project called Spacemen 3 in the 80s and 90s. But anyway, they made an album together called Reset, and I highly recommend it to anyone. But one thing that I loved about that album was that there were so many songs on that album that had this feeling that I wanted to try to make my own version of here, which is like there's songs on that. There's one called Go On, where they just keep singing like, give it to me, give it to me. And it like keeps like building and building, but then it just builds to nothing, but in a cool way. And then there's songs on there called like Edge of the Edge, where it's like you're up to the edge of, you know, and there's a song called Getting to the Point. There's a song called Everything's Been Leading to This, and it's the closer. And it's like, everything's been leading to this. Here it comes, here it comes, here it comes. But then, you know, it's only ever that part, you know, it's never some big explosion. And I just really liked that idea and felt like it echoed like where I was in my life at the time. And so, yeah, this is like my version of that. And I felt like that was actually a good way to start this project. And there's probably some relation also to the name of the album overall, like Trivial in the Greater Picture. That's something I just, and I'm sorry if this is a question you are going to ask later, but like that name as an album, this happens sometimes where I'm just like driving or I'm falling asleep and I think of like a phrase or something and I'm like, oh, that's just, I should write that down because I might be able to use that in the future. And that was the case there. I was probably thinking about something where I was like, whatever I'm thinking about probably is not going to matter, is going to end up being trivial. And I love the contrast of feeling those things, but only after like this period of anxiousness, you know, where you're unsure. And then when you look back, you can see that it was trivial. So yeah, those are just some of the like the themes and whatnot that have led to this song.
Well, thank you for adding all that. And yes, I was going to ask what the name or the title of the album was, but you know, it makes perfect sense, and having this especially as the opener reinforces that. Now for I was going to ask you a handful of other things, but for brevity, we're going to move on to the final segment of this podcast. I want to ask, so close to something out now on Spotify.
Yes.
You're gonna, the audience will have heard some of it at the very beginning, a little bit of the intro when we were talking about it, and there will be some as the outro, but purposely not putting too much of it because you need to go listen to it, yeah. Everyone. And so it's going to be in the description. Please go listen to Close to Something, but I'm gonna let you, is there anything else you want to say about your new single out now?
Oh man, you know, I feel like we covered a lot about it, you know? I think that I'm just excited for people to hear it. And at this point, we're just so close to the album coming out that I don't know, you know? I'm excited. I feel like we talked a good bit about it.
All right. We are certainly close to something. Corny jokes aside. So in the final part of this podcast, I'm going to ask you broadly, this is probably the easiest question you will get out of everything in here other than who are you, but what does music and writing music in your case mean to you as a person?
I think it's a lot easier to understand now than it did. There were so many things that were confusing to me about how important music was to me, or that I like, music has always been kind of the most important thing to me, even though I may not have understood that in the past. But it's like so clear now, looking back at like childhood photos of me as like a tiny little kid and stuff. And you know, I learned guitar probably in like first grade, and there's pictures of me like on my dad's lap or sitting next to him as a tiny kid, like playing guitar, him showing me that, or like me on his lap, like in front of like at a keyboard or piano, just banging notes and stuff. And it's funny. One of the things I just did as a kid that like my parents must have recognized, like, oh, he's into this, we should give him lessons, is I just learned, I would go see this dude who we met at a guitar center when I was buying my first electric guitar. His name's Mark Turley. And my parents would pay him for me just to go over to, he had like sort of a garage studio sort of thing. And this is upstate New York still in like first and second grade. And I would go and just like maybe once a week or something, I would just go and bang on his drum kit, and like technically was like learning like drums. But I would just play, I would have my favorite songs at the time, which is funny. Like my first ever favorite band at like ages 7, 8 or like 9 was Green Day, which is funny because you said it kind of reminded you of Green Day a little bit. And someone else said that, which is hilarious because I haven't really like ever had a period where I've been like influenced by them, except like back then when I was young. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, like those are really important to me. But then throughout like elementary school, middle school, high school, I, you know, would play guitar. And middle school and high school, my big thing, apart from like just all these STEM classes I was taking and having fun with, like the thing outside of like my school that I really liked was musical theater and performing and learning songs and taking voice lessons and stuff. So it felt like I had that like outlet for such a long time that when I came to college, I knew I didn't want to do musical theater anymore. And I was like, I guess I just keep being an engineer, you know, just keep learning that. There was a turning point where when I was starting to write my own music, I realized like, this is what I gotta do, like for my life's purpose or whatever. And looking back, it's so much clearer now. But I really feel fortunate that I've been able to set my life up in a way to where most of like what I'm involved with, whether it's work, like in mixing a live band at a venue, or like making music with my friends or making my solo music, it's just like having my life revolve around music has been so much more fulfilling. So it's way easier now to look back and realize like that it's kind of always been the most important thing, even when I didn't, you know, understand it.
It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. So to flip the coin around, so I'm going to ask the question, what does music theory mean to you in your life or in your development? And I'm going to take an answer away from you. Yes, it is a useful tool, music theory. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say it is an essential tool. That doesn't mean everyone on the planet needs to be sitting in a music theory one classroom. Everyone uses music theory in some very fundamental way, even if they wouldn't label it that. Mm-hmm. Because music theory is so encompassing. It's like saying we all use grammar. Of course we do. We say sentences, you know. But so other than music theory being a useful tool, what are your perceptions of it, the institution, the use of it, the practice, so on?
I think that yes, you know, to state some of the obvious, it's a useful tool. It's something that I'll start personally. I think that these days, for the music that I make, I feel like I try to have, I think that I try to keep my idea of music theory like in a balance, to where there's some music that feels like it's that I'll hear that I don't personally connect with as much, that feels like so much driven by theory. There's artists that like are they're technically they're so good and I have a lot of respect for, but I can't like connect with their music so much. Like one example, and I said I wasn't gonna throw shade to anyone, but this is like it's not shade necessarily, but like Jacob Collier, like his music, he's great. He's
I
great.
knew you were going to say that. I
Okay,
saw it coming. But
that's hilarious.
I'll give my take on Jacob Collier in a second. Keep going.
Okay, sure. So like I think that it can sound really pretty, but and you got to appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into just having all of these super complex chords and different things. And but I try to balance it with remembering that some of my favorite artists ever, like the Beatles, for example, had some, you know, like they might have taken piano lessons as a kid and they have like their producer George Martin to like influence, you know, to add in like that sort of experienced theorist sort of perspective to orchestrate things out really beautifully. But they will just be like listening to records from the 50s and 40s when they're making stuff back in the 60s and just noticing chords that sound cool. And they're like, I just want to take that chord and use it here and like just figure it out on a piano, you know, without like really like knowing how to play piano in quotations. And so I feel like I try to just balance it out with understanding. I think that the theory is useful to understand where you can go wrong, more so than like using it to do things correctly. And what I mean is like I think that my understanding of theory from like my schooling and whatnot is helpful for like if I'm trying to make a harmony part for vocals or something, like background vocals and there's harmony. If I'm like, oh, why does that not sound right? The answer might be like accessible in my brain to myself as like, oh, well, it's because there's, you know, these parallel fifths happening and it's not very pleasing in this instance or something. And so it's helpful for me to maybe correct things that otherwise, without knowing much about theory, like I might not have corrected and would just be like slightly jarring on a subconscious level. I feel like it's helpful for when you need to, being able to put words to things the same way that grammar, like you were saying, where it's like if someone uses slightly incorrect grammar, you sometimes like you can perceive it and it just it colors it and like what they're saying in a way, whereas like if they're, I don't know, it's like intentionality with it versus not, I think is something I notice.
I would agree. I'm going to slightly disagree with some of the framing of, I think even still, some elements of music theory are so well ingrained in your mind, just as with grammar, language grammar, that is, and musical grammar in this case, that it still does unlock many possibilities of intuitive action, not just reaction. Because I agree that the conscious, ooh, that doesn't sound great, or I'm trying to accomplish this, you can then use that part to intentionally use different parts of music theory. But on a fundamental philosophical level, your training and experience through elements of music theory allows you to not always have to consciously say, I need to achieve this. I need to use this to do that. You just do it, which in some way is from your music theory training. But that's more semantics. It's
Yeah,
essentially
and
what
I
you're
agree
saying.
with that. I yeah.
But okay, so Jacob Collier.
Oh, yeah.
I always need to be careful because I suppose in some way I'm a mildly public figure with a podcast. But Jacob Collier's music is beautiful and it's great. I have a slight issue sometimes with the obsession of process when it comes to it. For example, and I agree with what you were saying. For example, there was a colleague of mine, I'm going to omit his name because I don't know if he's comfortable with it. There's a colleague of mine in our popular music class who did he decided not to present on it for other unrelated reasons, but he was doing an analysis of a Jacob Collier piece that had like a like 7-8 part polyrhythm. Sounds like something Jacob Collier would do.
Yeah, sure.
And the note and Jacob Collier puts out notations of his music too, so you can see exactly what he's doing. And it's really neat. It's very fascinating. It's brilliant. He's a magician when it comes to that, really. I would argue, though, that the effect that that 8-7 layer polyrhythm can be achieved in 100 other significantly less complicated, less theory heavy ways, because it just sounds like it's a cloud of sound, essentially. It's very hard, unless if you're a rhythm guru and you listen to it many times over, which many people do in analysis, you're not going to perceive it as a very multi-layer polyrhythm. It's a cloud of sound. That's what the process is achieved. But there is this is not necessarily a critique of Jacob Collier himself, but there's this zeitgeist of superiority in the process of the music that I'm not comfortable with. I'm not going to make a claim so bold to say that Jacob Collier perpetrates that. That's way too harsh not to put intentionality on someone. He's a brilliant guy, but I don't like the obsession, even in popular music, as we're talking about right now, with obsession over process. So I can agree with you with that. Does that make sense?
It does. I actually, like, while you're saying that, I came up with a good analogy that I think that summarizes my point with it.
Okay.
And it's one thing that I learned really early on that helped with songwriting and being like the label of like songwriter, which is technically something that, you know, I could go back to labels that I fall under as an artist. Something that really helped me was this idea that it helped me with imposter syndrome on one level. And it's this idea that I just, like, read some quote about, it was talking about Kurt Cobain with Nirvana and him as the songwriter of that, where he was never crazy skilled technically, like as a guitarist, as some playing guitar. And that's something I've never been too. Like, my history is self-taught, and would just, for years until I was writing my own songs, I just had an acoustic guitar, an electric, and like, it would just be something that I would pull up the chords to my favorite songs and stuff and would just learn it just for fun. So, like, that being my background, I felt at first a little imposter syndrome, sort of about, like, you know, these people that can just do these crazy, like, things on guitar, or these people that just do, go absolutely nuts and have practiced scales, like, insanely every day. Classical, or even like the people that do that outside of that. But back to Kurt Cobain, I read something that was describing him as focusing more on developing like his abilities on guitar only as much as it serves like him as a songwriter. And that's something that I've resonated with, where it's like, I feel like I use pretty basic chords as the start, but I feel like I've developed my use of chords and coming up with them on guitar in a way that has helped me grow as a songwriter, but less as like technically a crazy guitarist. And that is something that I look at too. And again, like, you know, I really don't like being too negative about other people, but like, I don't know, there's sometimes like there's bands that I hear, whether it's local or like things, you know, on streaming, the bigger artists, where just because you have like musicians that are really technically intricate and whatnot, performers, does not mean you're gonna have like an emotional connection in your heart to a song. But then there will be artists that, like, there's someone named Daniel Johnston, who is like an incredible songwriter from the 80s and 90s and 2000s, who is super troubled person and suffered from like a number of different like mental illnesses, and his recordings are really poor. He was like not a great musician technically. He would just record like onto like 4-track cassettes, like him just poorly playing guitar and singing it, you know. But like, and those old recordings now like have so many streams because they're just so emotional. Like, you can still just connect with it, even though he's not doing like crazy things on guitar. And I feel like, going back to theory, that there's like a parallel between that type of idea with like being technically a really good craftsman, whatever, like skilled on your instrument, and also like with that, with music theory, maybe with Jacob Collier or something, you know?
I agree. Performative music theory. I would throw in another, maybe more commercial music, popular aspect, is I think of like the guitarist Santana. I bet you he could rip a amazing, highly technical guitar solo. But if you listen to his most popular albums, they're really not. And That is perfectly fine because it serves the art that he's doing, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing wrong with making an insanely complex theoretical thing for the sake of it, but it's the intentionality as we're talking about now.
Yeah. It's
So
like it was just to, like one thing I just thought of is like you saying earlier that one of your favorite, like not just songs, but pieces being Stand By Me, and that being so simple chord wise, theory wise, but it's still like I assume if you love it so much, it's one of those songs that just like cuts into your, like it goes past your brain right into your like soul, into your heart. And that's the type of stuff I'm after, and sometimes theory is a tool I can use to help that. But yeah, I guess like something that I always am wanting to be cautious of is not to go too far into where it becomes the performative theory stuff. Anyway, that's my little interjection.
No, you're completely right. Stand By Me is I could talk for hours about that song and what it means to me. And my favorite this is always difficult to do, but like my favorite artists are like John Denver, Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh yeah, huge fan.
So not known for the deepest theoretical sense, and some especially John Denver, very simple song forms, but it's more what it emotionally connects and means. So that is what I value in my personal music. But so we're coming to the end here. So we've talked about a bit already, but so today is close to something. Of course, everyone go out and listen to that. But this coming Friday, as we've said a couple times, is the album Trivial in the Greater Picture. Is there anything else you want to share with the audience about that as a preview?
I think
What
that
to expect? What to expect?
yes, I would the one thing that I would hint about with this album to people as it's coming out is how hard it was to choose singles from it and how much I deliberated over that, and ultimately still it not being 100% successful in showing all the ideas that are going to be in it and whatnot and what some of the, like the best songs are. I think that if you liked the singles at all, or if you're someone that's listened to them, I would highly recommend listening to some of those, the non-single songs, because they are still some of the favorite ones for me that I go back and listen to, or like my roommates or some of my fans that have heard me play all these songs live already, they'll be so surprised when they've heard that like certain ones are not, were not singles, or it's like, how is that not a single? And so that really I'm just excited because there's these songs for them to all come out at once, some of these other ones. I'm just really excited for people to hear those, because those, like, some of them easily could have been singles or whatnot.
Excellent, exciting stuff. So, Dylan, what would be the, of course, your contact information is going to be in the description of this episode on any platform that someone is hearing this on. It'll be on the social media posts and on the contributor page on our host website. But what would be the best way for people to contact you with questions, inquiries, comments, possibly even purchasing some physical media of your album? What would be the best way?
Yeah, I would say if you have Instagram, I always am pretty fast at responding to people on there. The Housing Crisis Instagram is just at the Housing Crisis, so that's nice. And then also, I don't know if you're someone that doesn't really use Instagram, you can just shoot me an email, and I'll respond to it. It's my email is thehousingcrisismusic@gmail.com. You can check those out, and if you go to the Instagram, there's also like the first link, only link there in the bio is the link tree that has like everything in it. And that can be useful. That would probably be useful for ordering things, or legit if you just like DM me on Instagram or shoot me an email. If you want a, an out CD or tape, we can for sure do something there. But yeah, those are my the main ways to contact.
Excellent. And so, in closing of the show, I'm going to give you the last note here, which is if you were to say to the audience anything on the topic of music theory, composition, artistry, the industry, music making, life, whatever it would be, what would you say?
I would say that the more varying types of worlds of music that you can immerse yourself in or learn from, the better, at least in my own experience, because I felt like getting a degree in theory and composition at UF, I learned so much and it was incredible. And all of that is carried with me and shows up in the music that I make in different ways. But if that was the only experience with music that I had here in Gainesville and whatnot these last like 5 years, it certainly would be so much more limited than what I've been able to discover in the world I've been able to discover within like the realms of local music and the community of people that make music that can't or choose not to do it through an academic setting. I feel like everything that I carry with me is just like a combo of just all of those places. And there's so much music being made that's just incredible that like you can just emotionally connect to so much by people locally, wherever you are, if you find it in your local music scene. And I suppose that I wished that they were more connected, the worlds of academia and the worlds of pop music and what people are doing outside of school. But I think that our generation is, I don't think it's really a like massive problem because I think that bridge is being gapped, you know, like those worlds are being connected as we're talking right now, like those things are underway, and there more people are making music right now, I figure, than any other time in history, because all it takes now is a laptop and that's it at the bare minimum, you know. And so we're seeing so much more music being made by more types of people. It's a very beautiful time for that. So I don't know where all this is leading. Maybe that's thematically consistent with the single today. So there we go.
We are certainly close to something.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Beautiful. So everyone, audience, today out right now. Again, I keep plugging it. I'm going to do it one last time in the description of the... Well, not one last time because I'm going to record an outro after this. But Close to Something is out right now. The final promotional single for the album that is coming out this Friday, June 21st, Trivial in the Greater Picture. So, Dylan O'Brien, The Housing Crisis, thank you very much for coming on to this episode of the Theorist-Composer Collaboration. This has been a great conversation. I love your work, your music, and I hope everyone else enjoys it just as much as I have and your other listeners have as well. Thank you very much for coming on to the podcast today.
Of course, Aaron. This was like the most... For sure, the most fun interview I've ever had talking about my music. And this was such a joy the whole time. So thank you so much for reaching out to me.
Hello, this is Aaron again. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist-Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to The Housing Crisis, Dylan O'Brien, for joining the podcast and for sharing their new single, Close to Something. Dylan's contact info is listed both in the description of this episode, as well as the corresponding contributor page on the TCC host website as well, and I would appreciate it if you could show him some support, especially by streaming the newly released single, Close to Something. It is really something cool and special to be part of the press releases and promotion for The Housing Crisis for their upcoming album, Trivial in the Greater Picture. And, of course, an almost simultaneous release with the new single, Close to Something. It was quite an experience and honor to be given access to music for analysis before its release, which I didn't even know that it would be a surprise release either. I loved my conversation with Dylan, especially with his cross experiences in both commercial and academic music, which, as we explored in this episode, is a rough way of describing it. Thank you again to Dylan O'Brien, The Housing Crisis, for joining this episode, and for sharing his newly released single, Close to Something. Out now and available for streaming on all platforms. The links are in the description. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist-Composer Collaboration, make sure to subscribe to our email listing on the homepage of our host website and follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. Relevant links in the description. You can also listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform you're choosing. Again, all relevant links are in the description. TCC episodes are posted weekly on Mondays, and don't miss our weekly blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. I'm also excited to promote that our next featured composer is Isabella Temperville and her album Infernal Suite. As a heads up, this episode will be a particularly long one as we'll be discussing, exploring, and discovering the lore of the world within Infernal Suite that Isabella created, with its own backstory, concepts, definitions, and dynamics, which were manifested into this album. There will be more information on this in the upcoming blog post, and, of course, in the next full episode. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms, because you won't want to miss it. But, until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.